Hey everyone, welcome back to The Deep Dive, your shortcut to truly understanding complex topics.
Great to be here.
Today, we're plunging into, well, the often misunderstood but incredibly dynamic world of insurance and reinsurance.
It really is dynamic. A lot going on under the surface.
Exactly. It's where some of the biggest risks on the planet, you know, think hurricanes, wildfires, even these huge lawsuits, meet really sophisticated financial strategies.
That's right. It's all about managing massive potential volatility.
And we're going to explore how some companies don't just, you know, survive in this high-stakes environment, but actually thrive, turning that volatility into opportunity.
Some navigate it exceptionally well.
Right. So our mission today is to unpack a pretty comprehensive investment research analysis of a key player in this space, Arch Capital Group LTD, or ACGL.
ACGL, yeah.
Yeah.
A fascinating company to look at.
We've sifted through the research, aiming to pull out the most vital insights, helping you grasp what makes Arch Capital tick, how it navigates this really complex industry, and, well, what its journey means for you as someone curious about the forces shaping our financial landscape.
Should be a good discussion.
Let's get started. Okay, so let's unpack this first bit. The global property and casualty, or P&C, industry. It's been on a bit of a roller coaster. And right now, it seems like it's in a pivotal transition.
Uh-huh. Pivotal is a good word for it.
Our analysis shows the U.S. P&C market coming off its best underwriting performance in, what, over 15 years, with return on equity ROE hitting a cyclical high of 14% in early 2024.
Yeah, that 14% was definitely a peak, a really strong number for the industry.
It sounds phenomenal, but what does that really tell us about the industry's health? Is it sustainable?
Well, it tells us we were firmly in what's known as a hard market. You can kind of think of the underwriting cycle like a pendulum. You know, in a hard market, prices are strong, terms are tight, insurers are highly profitable. Usually happens after big losses or when capital gets scarce.
Right. And a soft market.
That's the opposite. Lots of capital flowing in, intense competition, everyone's chasing business. So prices go down and profits get squeezed.
Got it. So that 14% ROE was the peak of the hard market swing.
Definitely. The data now points towards, well, normalization. ROE is expected to settle around 9.5% for full year 2024, maybe 10% in 2025.
So dropping back closer to normal levels.
Exactly. Much closer to the industry's typical cost of capital, which is usually somewhere in that 10% to 11% range. It signals the pendulum is swinging back towards a more balanced market. Still profitable, but, you know, less frothy.
And what did that mean for the bottom line for underwriting profit?
It's reflected in the combined ratio. That's a key metric. It measures underwriting profit. Anything below 100% means you're making money on the policies themselves. The forecast is around 98.5% for 2024 and 2025. Now, that's a big improvement from 102.3% in 2023 when they were actually losing money on underwriting.
Right. Over 100 is a loss.
But it also means those super high underwriting margins we saw at the peak, they're getting a bit leaner. Things are tightening up.
It sounds like a really complex environment. Mm-hmm. And here's where our analysis says it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
We're seeing a significant divergence in pricing trends.
Uh-huh. Different lines of business are behaving very differently.
Yeah. Commercial property lines, after seeing these huge rate hikes, they're now decelerating. Increases slowed from almost 12% down to just 6% by late 2024. Why is that happening? Why the softening in property?
Well, softening in property is it's a classic market reaction, really.
Okay.
When a segment becomes very profitable, like property did, it naturally attracts more underwriting capacity. New players jump in, existing ones write more. It's like, imagine a busy street with one coffee shop making a killing. Soon, you get three more coffee shops opening up, right? That increased supply forces everyone to compete harder, maybe lower prices. That's pretty much what's happening in commercial property. Capacity floods back in.
Makes sense. But you said there's a divergence. What's the contrast with other areas?
Right. Contrast that with casualty lines, things like commercial auto, umbrella policies, excess liability. Those areas are actually maintaining strong pricing resilience. Rates are staying firm or even still going up.
Why the difference? What's keeping casualty prices up?
The core reason, it's something called social inflation.
Okay, I've heard that term. What exactly? It's not like CPI, right?
No, totally different. It's not about your grocery bill.
Right.
Social inflation refers to this persistent, deeply entrenched challenge driven by rising litigation costs, broader legal definitions of liability, and importantly, a trend of larger jury awards, sometimes for, you know, non-economic damages that are hard to quantify.
Wow. And that's having a real impact.
A huge impact. To give you a sense of the scale, the industry faced a staggering 16 billion, billion with a B, in adverse reserve omissions during 2024 alone.
What does that mean, adverse reserve additions?
It means insurers had to set aside way more money than they initially estimated for past claims, specifically because these legal costs are escalating so much more than expected. It raises real concerns about how accurate their initial loss picks were for prior years.
So that uncertainty keeps prices firm in casualty.
Exactly. Insurers are charging more because they're genuinely uncertain about the ultimate cost of these long-tail claims.
So for a diversified insurer, one that plays in both property and casualty, this kind of split market must present both a challenge and a massive opportunity.
Precisely. It's a huge strategic puzzle. How do you shift your focus dynamically to capture the best returns?
How do they do it? Where does the capital flow?
Well, capital always seeks the highest risk-adjusted returns, right? So the high profitability we saw in property that attracted all this new capacity, which naturally compresses future returns in that area, competition heats up.
Okay.
But social inflation, that systemic uncertainty in casualty, it makes capital providers very cautious about jumping heavily into those lines. They're wary of the long-term claims cost uncertainty.
So caution in casualty keeps some players out, allowing others to maintain pricing.
Exactly. It allows the disciplined underwriters, the ones with real expertise in those lines, to maintain pricing power. So this dynamic gives a distinct advantage to companies that have deep expertise in both property and casualty and other specialty areas.
They can pivot.
Yes. They can pivot their growth engine, maybe pull back a bit on property where returns are normalizing, and lean more into casualty and other specialty lines where the pricing is still strong. It's all about maximizing those risk-adjusted returns through the cycle.
Okay, let's pivot ourselves now to the global reinsurance sector. This is the insurance for insurance companies, the ultimate shock absorber for these large-scale risks. Our analysis suggests this sector is in a period of considerable strength.
It is. Reinsurers reported generally robust results in 2024. We saw strong combined ratios, impressive ROEs, especially for a subset of the global players, like 86.8% combined and 17% ROE. Pretty healthy.
So what's fascinating about that strength? How is it reshaping the market?
Well, what's fascinating is how that strength, particularly the huge buildup of capital, is now changing the market dynamics. Global dedicated reinsurance capital, the money backing reinsurers, hit a record $769 billion at the end of 2024.
Wow, that's a massive number.
It is. It moderated slightly to $720 billion by Q1 2025, even after some early catastrophe losses, but it's still a huge pool of capital.
And what does that abundance of capital do?
It creates a much more competitive environment for reinsurance buyers, the primary insurance companies. It's leading to more favorable conditions for them, especially as we headed into the mid-year 2025 renewals.
So prices coming down a bit.
We're seeing property reinsurance pricing moderate, yeah, especially after those dramatic rate increases we saw post-Hurricane Ian. For accounts that haven't had major losses, you might see stable pricing or even slight reductions.
But is it becoming a soft market again?
Not entirely. Discipline remains. Crucially, reinsurers are still holding firm on higher attachment points and stricter terms.
Explain attachment points for us.
Sure. Think of an attachment point like a deductible, but on a massive scale for an insurance company. It's the level of loss the original insurer, the cedent, has to cover before the reinsurer steps in and starts paying.
Ah, okay. So a higher attachment point means the primary insurer takes more of the initial hit.
Exactly. Even if the reinsurance premium goes down slightly, the primary insurer is retaining more of that initial layer of risk. Reinsurers are showing a clear preference to avoid those lower, more frequent sort of attritional property losses. They want to focus on the true catastrophe layers.
So with property reinsurance stabilizing, maybe moderating a bit, the market's focus has decisively shifted. Our sources say it's now on casualty reinsurance. What's the outlook there?
Much more cautious. The outlook for casualty reinsurance is definitely tinged with concern.
Why? Same reasons as primary casualty?
Pretty much, yes. Reinsurers are increasingly worried about those U.S. liability loss trends, the ongoing impact of social inflation we talked about, and the potential for further adverse prior year reserve development trickling up to them.
So they might have to pay out more than expected on old contracts.
That's the fear. So many reinsurers are reevaluating their appetite for casualty risk. They're becoming more selective about who they partner with and what risks they take on, and they're definitely pushing for continued rate adequacy, higher prices to offset that heightened uncertainty. It echoes exactly what's happening in the primary P&C casualty market.
And what does this all mean for the broader market picture? especially with the growing influence of alternative capital, things like insurance-linked securities or ILS.
Right. Alternative capital is a huge factor now. Its growth has been, well, explosive.
Like catastrophe bonds.
Exactly. The catastrophe bond market, for instance, saw record issuance in the first half of 2025. Total alternative capital in the non-life sector, which includes cat bonds, collateralized reinsurance, sidecars, it's now surpassed $113 billion.
Wow. And where does that money typically go?
This massive growing pool provides an additional layer of highly competitive capacity, but it's primarily focused on peak property catastrophe risks. Think major hurricanes, earthquakes in specific zones.
So it adds more competition specifically for property reinsurance.
Precisely. Its influence is a key factor contributing to that softening rate environment we see in property reinsurance. It gives cedents, the companies buying reinsurance, more options and greater pricing leverage, especially for their top-end catastrophe protections. It really fuels that competitive landscape for property cat risk.
Okay, shifting gears slightly. How do broader macroeconomic forces like interest rates and inflation play into all this for the P&C industry? Our analysis points to a powerful and dual-sided influence.
That's a good way to put it. They really cut both ways. Let's start with interest rates.
Okay.
Higher interest rates are a significant and pretty much unambiguous tailwind for insurers.
A tailwind? How so?
Well, P&C carriers hold vast investment portfolios, mostly in fixed income securities like bonds, to back the claims they'll eventually have to pay. As their old, lower-yielding bonds mature, they're now reinvesting that money at substantially higher yields.
Ah, so they're earning more on their investments.
Exactly. This directly boosts their net investment income, which is a crucial component of their overall earnings. The average investment yield for the U.S. P&C industry is projected to climb from 3.5% in 2023 up to maybe 4.1% in 2025.
That's a pretty significant jump.
It is, and it provides a vital earnings cushion. This extra income can actually help offset some of that potential margin compression we talked about on the underwriting side as competition heats up. In 2024 alone, net investment income for the industry rose by 20% to $79 billion. It's a really strong stabilizing force right now.
Okay, so higher interest rates are generally a positive.
Right.
What about inflation? Headline CPI, consumer price inflation, seems to be moderating. Does that alleviate concerns for insurers?
Not entirely, no, because, as we discussed earlier, that specific issue of social inflation remains the most significant headwind, especially for U.S. casualty lines.
So even if the cost of bread isn't rising as fast, the cost of lawsuits is.
You got it. While headline CPI might be cooling, that underlying trend of heightened litigation, plaintiff-friendly legal decisions, larger jury awards, it means liability claims costs are still rising at a rate that seems to be far outpacing general economic inflation.
And that disconnect creates problems.
Big problems. That uncertainty around the ultimate cost of these long-tail claims is a key factor behind that recent wave of adverse reserve development across the industry. And it justifies, in the eyes of insurers and reinsurers, the need for continued pricing discipline in those casualty segments. It's a persistent underlying pressure they just can't easily escape right now.
This raises another really important question. What's happening with catastrophe risk itself?
Right.
Our sources indicate a structural shift, a persistent upward trend in both the frequency and severity of insured losses.
Yeah, the trend lines are pretty clear, unfortunately. Global insured catastrophe losses seem to be on something like a 5-7% annual growth trajectory.
Wow.
Projections put them around $145 billion for 2025. And 2024 was the fifth consecutive year where global insured losses topped $100 billion.
And we started 2025 with those unprecedented LA wildfires.
Yeah.
Our sources estimated $40 billion in losses just from that one event right at the start of the year.
That was a staggering event, yeah. It really highlights this complex and evolving risk landscape.
What's driving this escalation? Is it just climate change?
It's not just one single factor. It's really a confluence of things. First, you have socioeconomic factors. Things like continued economic growth, urbanization, more people moving to and building in hazard-prone areas like coastlines or wildland interfaces. That means there's simply a higher concentration of valuable assets exposed when something happens.
Okay, more stuff in harm's way.
Right. Second, yes, climate change is widely believed to be increasing the severity and possibly the frequency of certain perils like hurricanes, wildfires, and extreme rainfall.
And third?
Third is just the rising cost of rebuilding, basic materials, lumber, labor. General inflation means the insured cost of repairing or replacing damaged property is simply higher than it used to be.
So all these factors combined?
They create this environment of heightened and evolving risk, which underpins a strong, structural, and frankly growing demand for high-quality insurance and reinsurance. Reinsurance in particular plays that critical role as the primary financial shock absorber for these really big peak loss events.
The bigger they get.
Well, Swiss Re, one of the major reinsurers, actually estimates there's roughly a 1 in 10 probability that total insured losses could exceed $300 billion in 2025. They call that a peak loss year.
Goodness, $300 billion. That really underscores why you need a well-capitalized and disciplined reinsurance market.
Absolutely essential.
And one critical evolution we're seeing, mentioned in the analysis, is the growing impact of secondary perils. Things like severe convective storms, thunderstorms, hail, tornadoes, plus wildfires, floods. Why are these becoming such major contributors to losses?
That's a really important point. Traditional catastrophe models, the computer models insurers use, have historically struggled to accurately predict the frequency and severity of these secondary peril events. They were often better at modeling, say, a major hurricane hitting Miami than a cluster of severe thunderstorms rolling across the Midwest.
So they were being underpriced.
Often, yes, leading to unexpected losses for insurers and reinsurers. This is forcing a fundamental reevaluation and repricing of these risks across the entire market.
How are they adapting?
We're seeing a clear shift away from relying purely on third-party vendor models. Now it's moving towards a more holistic approach. That means incorporating much more internal underwriting judgment, developing proprietary analytics, and using stricter policy terms and conditions like higher deductibles for specific perils like hail or wind.
So the underwriters who really understand these specific localized risks have an advantage.
A distinct advantage, yes. Sophisticated underwriters who possess deep expertise and better data capabilities to model, price, and manage these complex, often very localized, secondary peril risks are definitely better positioned in this changing environment.
Okay, with that complex landscape firmly in mind, let's turn our attention specifically to Arch Capital Group LTD, ACGL. Our analysis introduces them as a premier global provider of specialty insurance, reinsurance, and mortgage insurance solutions, known for its strategically diversified platform.
Yeah.
What does that actually mean in practice for a company like Arch?
Well, Arch Capital operates through three quite distinct yet complementary business segments. It's the structure that really defines them.
Okay, let's break them down. First up.
First, their insurance segment. This group offers a broad range of specialty property and casualty insurance products pretty much worldwide, but they really concentrate on niche areas that require specialized underwriting expertise.
Like what kind of niches?
Think things like construction risks, excess and surplus casualty, which is often harder to place business professional lines like directors and officers liability, specialized programs for lenders, travel insurance, accident and health, complex stuff.
So not standard home and auto.
Generally not, no. This segment has been a major growth engine for Arch. They wrote about $6.9 billion in net premiums in fiscal year 2024, which is up a healthy 17% from 2023.
And they made a significant acquisition there recently.
Yes. A key strategic move was their August 2024 acquisition of Alliance's U.S. Midcourt and Entertainment Insurance businesses. This was a big deal. It significantly enhances Arch's capabilities and scale in the U.S. middle market businesses that are larger than small businesses, but not huge corporations. Plus, it added entertainment insurance as a new specialized niche for them.
And that's already contributing.
It is. The analysis notes it made a material contribution to their Q2 2025 results already. So it's hitting the ground running.
Okay, so a strong specialty insurance arm. What's the second segment?
The second is their reinsurance segment. Arch is a leading global player here, offering both treaty reinsurance, where they cover a whole portfolio of an insurer's business, and facultative reinsurance, which covers individual specific large risks.
And what kind of risks do they reinsure?
It's a highly diversified portfolio, everything from property catastrophe risk, property risk excluding cat events, casualty lines, marine, aviation, and other specialty lines like cyber risk, trade credit, even agriculture.
So pretty broad.
Very broad. They've established themselves as a top 10 global reinsurance provider. And again, impressive growth. They hit a record $7.7 billion in net premiums in fiscal year 2024, which is up 18% over the prior year.
What's their strategy in reinsurance?
Their strategy really leverages their analytical capabilities and their global platform. They aim to provide sophisticated, often complex risk transfer solutions for their insurance company clients around the world.
Okay, insurance and reinsurance. And then there's the third leg of the stool, which our sources highlight as a key differentiator for Arch. the mortgage segment.
Yes, the mortgage segment is absolutely a key differentiator. It's been a really powerful source of diversified and historically quite stable earnings for Arch.
How does that work? What do they do in mortgage?
They're a global leader, primarily in the U.S., but also in Europe and Australia, in private mortgage insurance, or MI. This is insurance that protects mortgage lenders from losses if a borrower defaults on their residential mortgage, typically on loans with smaller down payments.
Ah, so it helps people buy homes with less money down.
Exactly. It enables homebuyers to purchase homes with, say, 5% or 10% down instead of the traditional 20%. Arch also participates in credit risk sharing transactions with the government-sponsored enterprises, the GSEs like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
And how has this segment performed?
Exceptionally well. It's been remarkably profitable for Arch. It generated $1.1 billion of underwriting income in fiscal year 2024, and that was its third consecutive year exceeding the billion-dollar mark in underwriting income.
Wow. That's impressive consistency.
It really is. This unique segment truly sets them apart from many traditional P&C insurers and reinsurers. It provides a kind of counter-cyclical anchor to their overall business.
So with these three distinct businesses, what's the cornerstone of Arch's overall strategy? Our analysis describes it as an unwavering commitment to a disciplined and opportunistic underwriting philosophy. And they explicitly call it cycle management. How does that actually work day to day?
Well, cycle management is absolutely core to their identity. The basic principles about actively managing their exposures and dynamically allocating their capital across that diversified platform. Insurance, reinsurance, mortgage, to whichever lines of business offer the most attractive risk-adjusted returns at that specific point in the underwriting cycle.
So they shift their focus depending on market conditions.
Precisely. It means they'll aggressively expand their writings in hard markets when pricing is favorable and terms are good. But just as importantly, they will prudently contract or sometimes even completely withdraw capacity from lines of business where pricing becomes inadequate during soft markets.
So profit over growth.
The ultimate priority is long-term profitability, definitely not just chasing short-term market share gains. They achieve this in part by focusing on those intellectually intensive specialty markets. We talked about the complex niche risks.
Why the focus there?
Because in those niches, their deep underwriting expertise, their proprietary data, and their analytical capabilities can give them a sustainable competitive advantage in pricing and risk selection. They're not just competing on price in commoditized markets.
How do they make those decisions? Is it all algorithms?
They describe it as an experience-led but data-driven approach. So it's about synthesizing the judgment and intuition of their experienced underwriters with rigorous quantitative analysis and data modeling. It's a blend of art and science.
This raises a really important question, especially given our earlier discussion about social inflation and reserving issues. How does Arch manage risk, particularly with those long-term claims in casualty lines?
Right, that's critical. A key component of their disciplined approach is a deliberately conservative and long-term view of risk management, especially when it comes to loss reserving.
How so?
Management explicitly states their practice is to recognize bad news quickly and good news over time. What that means in practice is they tend to set their initial loss reserves conservatively based on pretty comprehensive analysis. They then allow those reserves to mature, sometimes for years, until they have sufficient hard data to determine the ultimate loss cost with much greater certainty.
So they don't rush to release reserves and book profits early?
Generally, no. They prefer to let things develop. In an industry where inadequate reserving is, frankly, a primary cause of financial distress for companies, this prudent philosophy is a really key risk mitigator for Arch and crucial for their long-term success.
Do they look at broader risks, too?
Yes. They also have a robust enterprise risk management, or ERM, framework. This formally identifies, assesses, and manages risks across the entire organization, and it explicitly integrates emerging risks, including those related to climate change, into their overall risk register and business strategy.
So Arch's business model is clearly built on this extensive diversification. What does that mean in practice, beyond just having the three segments, and how does it give them a distinct edge?
Well, first, it means they have a truly global footprint, operating from over 60 offices across North America, Europe, Asia, Australia. That geographic spread helps diversify their exposure. They're not overly reliant on any single region's economy or regulatory environment.
Geographic spread. But the real power is the segments.
Yes, the most powerful diversification benefit really comes from that unique three-segment structure: specialty P&C insurance, global P&C reinsurance, and mortgage insurance. This combination creates a portfolio with distinct and, crucially, often uncorrelated risk drivers.
Uncorrelated. Give us an example.
Sure. Earnings from their P&C segments, insurance and reinsurance, are primarily influenced by things like the P&C underwriting cycle and the occurrence of catastrophe events. Big storms, earthquakes, they hit P&C results.
Hey.
But the mortgage segment's earnings, they're driven by completely different factors. The health of the housing market, mortgage origination volumes, consumer credit performance, unemployment rates, things largely unrelated to hurricanes.
Ah, I see. So they don't all tend to go up or down at the same time.
Exactly. There's often a counter-cyclical relationship. In years where Arch might face high catastrophe losses that negatively impact the P&C segments, the mortgage segment can provide a steady, reliable stream of underwriting income.
Which smooths out the overall results.
Precisely. It helps smooth the volatility of their consolidated results and protects the company's overall capital base. This diversification is a core pillar of Arch's business model, a key differentiator from many of its peers, and it's a fundamental reason why they've been able to consistently generate superior risk-adjusted returns over the long haul.
Now, it's important to acknowledge, Arch operates in highly competitive markets across all three of its segments. They face a whole range of competitors, right? Mm-hmm. From huge global carriers to very specialized players.
Oh, absolutely. The competition is fierce everywhere they play.
Who are some of these competitors, just to give us a sense of the landscape?
Sure. In their specialty insurance segment, they're up against really formidable, well-respected players like Chubb, W.R. Berkley, Markel, plus specialized divisions of other large insurers.
Okay, tough crowd. What about reinsurance?
In global reinsurance, where Arch is a top 10 player, they compete head-to-head with the giants. Think Munich Re, Swiss Re, and also other major Bermuda-based peers like Everest Group and Renaissanceere.
The heavyweights. And mortgage insurance.
In the U.S. private mortgage insurance market, where Arch is a leader through its Arch MI subsidiary, they compete with other key players like MGIC Investment Corp and Radian Group. And they also face indirect competition from government entities like the Federal Housing Administration, the FHA.
So yeah, it's a crowded and tough field across the board, which, as you said, makes Arch's consistent outperformance even more impressive.
It really does. They're clearly doing something right.
So despite this intense competition, our analysis suggests Arch has cultivated several durable competitive advantages, what we might call a moat, that have enabled it to consistently outperform. What are these distinct advantages that set them apart?
Well, the analysis points to a few key things. Probably the most significant, the most defensible competitive advantage is their underwriting expertise and that cycle management culture we've been talking about.
Why is that so hard to replicate?
Because it's not just a strategy memo that sits on a shelf. It's deeply embedded. It's a core operating principle that really permeates the entire organization, from the top down to the individual underwriters. They have demonstrated this consistent ability over many years to expand writings during hard markets and, just as importantly, to shrink or even exit lines of business when pricing becomes inadequate in soft markets.
And compensation plays a role.
A huge role. Their compensation structure is designed to explicitly align underwriters' incentives with long-term profitability, not just with hitting top-line premium volume targets. This discourages that common industry pitfall of chasing market share at any cost, which often leads to writing bad business that comes back to bite you when the cycle turns.
So that discipline is cultural.
It's a cultural discipline, exactly. And that's extremely difficult for competitors to replicate quickly. It's arguably the primary engine behind Arch's superior long-term growth in book value per share.
Okay, so culture and discipline number one. What else contributes to their moat?
Second is that diversified and complementary business platform we just discussed. That unique three-segment structure, specialty insurance, reinsurance, and mortgage insurance is a powerful structural advantage.
How so? Structurally?
It allows for more efficient capital allocation. Management can dynamically shift resources to the segment, offering the highest risk-adjusted returns at any given time. And crucially, the non-correlated nature of the mortgage insurance business relative to the P&C operations creates that more stable, less volatile, consolidated earnings stream.
Which gives them flexibility.
Right. It supports a strong balance sheet, gives them financial flexibility to act opportunistically, maybe make acquisitions or buy back stock, even during periods of market disruption that might stress their competitors. It's a fundamental strength few others have in quite the same way.
And their focus on specific niches, is that part of the moat?
Absolutely. Their leadership in specialty niches is a deliberate strategic choice. Arch focuses on those complex, intellectually intensive specialty lines. By generally avoiding the highly commoditized markets where price is the main differentiator, they can leverage their deep underwriting expertise and sophisticated data analytics to gain a pricing and risk selection advantage.
They understand the risk better.
They believe they do, yes. Which allows them to potentially achieve more favorable terms and sustain profitability over time in those niches. This specialization creates pretty high barriers to entry for more generalist competitors who lack that specific expertise or data.
Okay, and finally, their financial standing itself must be critical.
Indeed. Financial strength and market reputation are paramount in this business. Arch maintains excellent financial strength ratings from all the major rating agencies. We're talking AA from Standard & Poor's, A+ from AM Best.
And why are those ratings so important?
Well, these high ratings are essentially a prerequisite for competing at the highest levels, especially in reinsurance and large commercial insurance markets. They provide critical assurance to clients, brokers, and counterparties that the company has the financial wherewithal to pay claims, particularly on those long-tail policies or after major catastrophic events. This strong financial standing, combined with a hard-earned reputation for consistency, expertise, and paying claims fairly, solidifies Arch's position as a preferred partner in its chosen markets. It builds trust, which is invaluable.
Okay, let's dive into the numbers themselves now. Our analysis of Arch's financial performance over the past 5 years, say 2020 to 2024, it really shows a period of exceptional and profitable growth. It seems to prove their strategy works. What do these figures really tell us about their operational discipline?
Yeah, the data really does paint a compelling picture of both impressive scale and remarkable discipline. If you look at their insurance segment, gross premiums written nearly doubled between 2020 and 2024. That's rapid expansion.
Doubled. Wow. But was it profitable growth?
That's the key question, and yes. Crucially, even with that strong top-line growth, their combined ratio, remember, lower is better for profitability, improved significantly over that period, generally staying down in the low 90s. That indicates consistently profitable underwriting, even while growing fast.
Okay. What about the reinsurance segment?
The reinsurance segment saw even more dramatic growth. Gross premiums written there more than tripled over the same five-year period. Yeah. And again, importantly, their combined ratio remained exceptionally strong, consistently running in the low 80s. Those are truly industry-leading numbers for a reinsurer.
So the takeaway is they didn't just grow for growth's sake.
Exactly. They grew profitably. And that's much harder to do consistently in a cyclical industry than it sounds. It speaks volumes about their underwriting discipline during a favorable market period.
And that unique mortgage segment we keep coming back to. How does it stack up financially in this picture?
The mortgage segment really provides that bedrock of stability and profitability. As we mentioned, it consistently generated over $1 billion in underwriting income annually from 2022 through 2024. And its combined ratios were often down in the single digits, sometimes even negative in certain periods due to favorable reserve development.
Negative combined ratio, meaning they got paid more than they paid out.
Essentially, yes, due to releasing reserves set aside for prior year losses that ended up being lower than expected. That exceptional performance really underscores its role as that countercyclical anchor, providing reliable earnings even when other segments might face headwinds from cats or market cycles.
So overall, strong income growth and book value growth too.
Yes. Across the entire enterprise, Arch's consolidated net income grew substantially over this period, and maybe even more importantly for long-term value, their book value per share consistently increased, demonstrating robust value creation.
Beyond just the raw premium and income numbers, what do these figures translate to in terms of profitability and shareholder value? Our analysis points to Arch's superior underwriting and capital management as being key drivers here.
Absolutely. The metrics really bear that out. When we look at return on equity or ROE, which measures profitability relative to shareholder equity, Arch Capital has consistently generated ROE levels well in excess of both the industry average and its own estimated cost of capital.
How high did it get?
Well, their annualized operating ROE surged from about 11.5% back in 2021 up to a very strong 21.6% in 2023. It remained robust at 18.9% in 2024, reflecting both that highly profitable underwriting we saw and the rising contribution from investment income.
And that continued recently.
Yes. Even in Q2 2025, they reported an annualized operating ROE of 18.2%, demonstrating continued high return performance. These are top-tier numbers.
And the other key metric for insurers is book value per share growth, right? How have they done there?
Their track record on book value per share, or BVPS, growth is truly among the best in the entire industry. It's a core measure of how management is compounding shareholder wealth over time.
Give us the numbers.
Okay, so from $30.31 at the end of 2020, their BVPS grew to $53.11 by the end of 2024. That represents a compound annual growth rate, or CAGR, of approximately 15% per year.
15% annual growth in book value is very strong.
Very strong. And what's particularly notable is the growth in 2024 alone, it was 23.8%, even after adjusting for that large special dividend they paid out.
Wow.
And this strong compounding continued into 2025, with BVPS reaching $59.17 as of June 30th, 2025. This consistent and rapid growth in the underlying intrinsic value of the company is really the ultimate indicator of management's successful execution of its strategy over the long term.
Now, how does Arch manage its vast investment portfolio? This is the money backing all those policyholder liabilities. Our analysis describes a conservative and disciplined investment strategy.
That's accurate. Arch's investment strategy is indeed quite conservative, primarily focused on capital preservation and generating a stable, recurring stream of income.
So what do they invest in mostly?
The vast majority of their portfolio, something like 90% or more, is allocated to high-quality investment-grade fixed maturity securities, mostly bonds and short-term investments. The average credit quality was very high, AAA3 at the end of 2023.
High quality. Anything else notable about their bond portfolio?
Yes, a key element of their strategy, especially recently, has been maintaining a relatively short duration on that fixed income portfolio. At the end of 2023, the average effective duration was only about 2.91 years.
Why is short duration important, especially lately?
Well, that positioning was highly advantageous in the recent rising interest rate environment we've seen. Having a short duration meant their portfolio was less sensitive to falling bond prices as rates rose. More importantly, it allowed them to reinvest maturing bonds much faster at those new higher yields.
So they benefited more quickly from rising rates.
Exactly. They minimized the mark-to-market losses that many peers with longer duration portfolios experienced, and they captured the higher income sooner. The impact on their investment income is crystal clear.
How much did it grow?
Net investment income surpassed $1.0 billion for the first time in company history in 2023. That was a remarkable 106% increase from 2022 on a per-share basis.
A doubling in 1 year.
Pretty much. And that positive trend is continuing. Their pre-tax investment income yield rose further to 4.25% in Q2 2025. This growing and predictable stream of investment income provides a really strong foundation for future earnings and book value growth. It acts as that powerful tailwind we talked about, boosting overall profitability.
Okay, so Arch's impressive growth clearly hasn't happened by accident. Our analysis points to a combination of strong organic expansion, growing the business they already have, and disciplined strategic acquisitions. How have these two engines driven their success?
That's right. They've pulled both levers effectively. On the organic growth front, the company very skillfully capitalized on that hard P&C market cycle that really started accelerating back in 2020.
How did they do that?
By adhering strictly to that cycle management philosophy we discussed. When pricing and terms became attractive, Arch significantly expanded its premium writings in both its insurance and reinsurance segments. They met client demand while leveraging that attractive pricing environment.
Can you give an example of that growth?
Sure. In 2023, for instance, their insurance segment's net premiums written grew a strong 17%. But the reinsurance net premiums written surged an even more impressive 33% that year. Consolidated P&C gross premiums written were up nearly 19% in 2024.
So really leaning in when the market was good.
Exactly. It clearly demonstrates management's ability and willingness to effectively deploy capital and grow organically when market conditions warrant it.
Okay, that's organic. What about their strategy for growing through mergers and acquisitions, M&A?
Arch also has a well-established history of executing what the analysis calls value-accretive M&A. That means acquisitions that genuinely add to long-term shareholder value, not just empire building.
What's a key example?
Well, probably the most transformative acquisition in their history was buying AIG's United Guaranty mortgage insurance business back in 2016. That was a $3.4 billion deal.
Ah, and that's what made them a leader in MI.
Exactly. That deal established Arch as the world's largest mortgage insurer and created that highly profitable and diversifying third leg of their business model. It was a game changer for them.
And more recently?
More recently, as we touched on, their August 2024 acquisition of Alliance's U.S. MidCorp and entertainment insurance businesses marks another really important strategic move.
Why was that one strategic?
Because it provides Arch with immediate scale and capabilities in the large and attractive U.S. middle market P&C space, an area where they were previously somewhat underpenetrated. And it adds that new specialty niche in entertainment insurance.
And how much did that contribute?
The acquisition is already contributing materially to the insurance segment's growth. The analysis notes that in Q2 2025, the insurance segment's gross premiums written increased 27.5% year over year. But if you exclude the contribution from the Alliance acquisition, the underlying organic growth was about 3.6%.
Got it. So that M&A provided a huge boost to the reported growth number.
A very significant boost, yes. It clearly shows the impact strategic M&A can have.
Okay, so looking ahead now. Where does Arch go from here? Our analysis suggests they are well positioned, but maybe with a strategic evolution in their approach to growth. What does that mean?
Well, they certainly appear well positioned. While that broad-based pricing momentum we saw, especially in property lines, is moderating, management believes there are still significant opportunities ahead.
Where are those opportunities?
They remain particularly in casualty and various other specialty lines where pricing is expected to stay firm or even continue rising due to those underlying loss trends like social inflation. Arch's deep expertise and its global platform allow it to pivot its focus towards these more attractive areas to continue driving profitable growth.
And that big Alliance deal.
Right. The successful integration of the acquired Alliance businesses represents a really significant near to medium term growth catalyst. It gives Arch the foundation to build a much larger, more meaningful presence in that U.S. middle market P&C segment.
Any other growth avenues?
Well, they also continue to demonstrate an ability to innovate and expand into adjacent areas organically. The recent introduction of some new supplemental health insurance products is cited as an example. Plus, their global footprint always provides opportunities to potentially expand their presence in emerging markets, particularly perhaps in Asia, where insurance penetration is generally lower and the demand for reinsurance solutions is growing.
So the analysis talks about a subtle but important evolution in their growth strategy. What's changing?
I think the point is that the phase of massive, broad-based, organic expansion that was driven by a universally hard P&C market across almost all lines, that phase is naturally giving way to a more targeted approach now.
Okay.
The big Alliance acquisition, for example, signals a clear strategic decision to buy rather than try to build from scratch a significant presence in a desired new market segment like the U.S. middle market.
So more strategic M&A, perhaps.
It seems likely to be a key part of the strategy going forward. This looks like a forward-looking action, anticipating the normalization of the broader market cycle. It positions the company for its next phase of growth, which will likely be driven by a combination of potentially more strategic M&A, focused on market entry or gaining scale in specific areas, complemented by continued focused organic growth in those specific niches that continue to offer attractive risk-adjusted returns. It's becoming more selective.
Okay, this leads nicely into how Arch's management team decides where to put its capital. Our analysis lays out a clear and disciplined philosophy here, focusing on being prudent and effective stewards of shareholder capital. How does that work in practice?
They do have a very clear framework, and their actions, particularly throughout 2024 when they generated a lot of capital, really reveal a distinct hierarchy of priorities for deploying that capital.
To the top of the list.
First and foremost, the number one priority is always to fund profitable organic growth. That's the primary use of capital, especially when market conditions are attractive like they were in P&C recently. So in 2024, capital was directed toward their P&C units to fund growth in both new and existing accounts, capturing those solid returns.
Okay, organic growth first. What's second?
The second priority is to pursue strategic M&A. Deploying capital for acquisitions that can enhance their existing platform, add new capabilities, or provide entry into new, attractive markets. The Alliance acquisition is the perfect example of the second priority in action.
Makes sense. Grow organically. If you can do it profitably, look for smart acquisitions next. And after funding that growth, what's the third priority?
The third priority is to return excess capital to shareholders. After they've funded all the attractive organic and inorganic growth opportunities they see that meet their return hurdles, management is committed to returning any remaining excess capital back to the shareholders.
Okay. And Arch has a strong track record of returning capital. How do they typically do this, especially given they don't pay a regular quarterly dividend?
That's right. Their primary method, historically, has been through share repurchase programs, buybacks.
Okay.
They've historically been quite active and significant users of share buybacks. It's a key tool for them to manage their capital base efficiently, and it's a way to return capital, especially when they believe the company's shares are trading at a price below their estimate of intrinsic value.
And buybacks help boost metrics like book value per share, right?
Exactly. Share repurchases are inherently accretive, meaning they increase book value per share whenever they're executed at a price below the current book value per share. And Arch has been pretty active recently. They repurchased about $196 million worth of shares in Q1 2025 and another $163 million in Q2 2025.
So buybacks are the main tool, but you mentioned they don't pay a regular dividend.
Correct. Arch does not pay a regular quarterly common stock dividend, unlike many other large insurance companies. Their long-standing philosophy has been that they believe they can create more long-term value for shareholders by retaining that capital and compounding it internally through profitable underwriting and investment, or by opportunistically repurchasing shares when they're cheap.
They showed some pragmatism and flexibility on that front recently, didn't they? Our sources highlight a significant move in late 2024. They declared a special cash dividend of $5 per share, totaling approximately $1.9 billion. That's a huge payout for a company that doesn't normally pay dividends.
Yes. That large special dividend is, as the analysis says, highly informative. It tells you a lot about their capital discipline.
How so?
Well, think about it. After generating truly exceptional earnings and building up a lot of capital in 2023 and 2024, management's first priority, as we said, was to deploy that capital into high return underwriting opportunities, which they did. They also completed a strategic acquisition. But the choice to then return a very large sum, $1.9 billion, directly to shareholders via a special dividend, rather than, say, pursuing another major acquisition or dramatically accelerating buybacks even further.
What is that choice signal?
It suggests a high degree of capital discipline. It implies that at that specific moment, management viewed this direct return as the highest and best use for that particular quantum of capital. They didn't feel compelled to just spend it on growth for growth's sake if the expected returns weren't there.
So they weren't willing to chase marginal opportunities just to deploy capital.
Exactly. This action is a strong signal of management's unwillingness to chase growth by deploying capital into opportunities with potentially lower expected returns, especially as the market cycle was showing signs of maturing. It really underscores a strong commitment to prioritizing shareholder returns over growth for its own sake, which is what long-term shareholders generally want to see.
Okay, let's talk about the people leading the charge. Who leads Arch Capital? Our analysis describes them as a seasoned team of industry veterans with deep expertise.
That's fair. Arch Capital is indeed led by a very highly experienced team. The culture there is often described as quite entrepreneurial, but also collaborative. That's seen as crucial for attracting and retaining top underwriting and analytical talent in the very competitive specialty insurance market.
And there was a significant leadership change recently.
Yes. A key development occurred in October 2024. It was the well-telegraphed and, by all accounts, very seamless succession of their longtime CEO, Mark Grandison, by Nicholas Papadopoulos.
Is Papadopoulos new to Arch?
Oh, no, not at all. Mr. Papadopoulos is a true Arch veteran. He'd been with the company for over two decades, and importantly, had previously led both their reinsurance and their insurance groups at different times. So his appointment ensures a very high degree of strategic and cultural continuity. There are no big surprises expected there.
And the bench strength looks good, too.
It does. The strength of their leadership bench was further highlighted by the concurrent promotions of two other longtime Arch executives, David Gansberg and Mamon Rajeh, into president roles. They now oversee global insurance and mortgage operations and reinsurance operations, respectively. So deep experience throughout the senior ranks.
Okay, what about their overall track record as a management team? How have they performed?
Well, simply put, the management team's track record of creating shareholder value is exceptional. It's genuinely one of the best in the entire P&C insurance industry over the long term.
And how do we measure that success?
The primary metric, as we've discussed, is that long-term, consistent, and superior growth in the company's book value per share. That sustained performance across multiple different market cycles, hard markets, soft markets, catastrophes, recessions, it's direct evidence of the team's ability to successfully execute its disciplined underwriting and capital allocation strategy year after year. It's a testament to their deep understanding of the complex risks they underwrite and the markets they operate in.
Okay, beyond the top leadership team, what about the company's broader governance structure? How's it set up?
Arch Capital maintains what appears to be a strong corporate governance framework designed to ensure effective oversight from the board and, importantly, to align the interests of management with those of its shareholders.
How is the board structured?
Their board of directors is composed of 12 members. They serve staggered 3-year terms, which provides some continuity. And the analysis notes a commitment to ongoing refreshment to ensure an optimal balance of experience and fresh perspectives. For example, two long-serving directors retired in 2024, allowing for new members.
And a really key aspect of governance, especially for an underwriting company, is compensation alignment, right?
Absolutely critical. And aligning compensation with shareholder interests is described as a key tenet of Arch's governance and operating philosophy.
How is it aligned?
Both executive and underwriter compensation is structured to be closely aligned with generating long-term profitable results. The analysis quotes their 2023 annual report stating, "Underwriting compensation is aligned with shareholder results, meaning the profitability of the business is what ultimately drives underwriting decisions."
So underwriters get paid for writing profitable business, not just writing a lot of business.
That's the core idea. This structure incentivizes prudent risk-taking and a relentless focus on achieving adequate underwriting margins rather than just chasing sheer premium volume or market share. And as we've seen, that's absolutely critical for successfully executing their cycle management strategy. It keeps everyone focused on the bottom line.
All right. No investment comes without risks. And certainly as a global underwriter of complex risks, Arch Capital is naturally exposed to a variety of significant factors. What are some of the inherent industry risks that someone looking at Arch should really keep an eye on?
That's right. Understanding the risks is crucial. The analysis highlights several key ones. First, and probably most obvious, is catastrophe exposure.
Big storms, earthquakes.
Exactly. As a significant writer of property insurance and reinsurance globally, Arch has substantial exposure to financial losses from major natural and man-made catastrophic events. Hurricanes, earthquakes, wildfires, floods, even potentially terrorism. A single very large event or an unusual accumulation of smaller events in a short period could cause substantial volatility in their quarterly or annual results.
And that risk might be increasing.
Well, the perceived increasing frequency and severity of certain perils, possibly linked to climate change, as we discussed, represents an ongoing evolving challenge for their risk modeling and capital management. It's a constant focus.
Okay, cat risk. What's next?
Second is underwriting cycle timing. We've talked a lot about the P&C industry being inherently cyclical. Arch's profitability is highly dependent on its ability to skillfully navigate these hard and soft market phases.
What's the risk here? Misjudging it.
Yeah, the risk is either getting caught in a prolonged soft market where returns are poor across the board, or perhaps misjudging the turning points of the cycle. If they fail to accurately assess conditions and start writing underpriced business, assuming the market is harder than it is, that could negatively impact their future profitability down the line. Their cycle management track record is strong, but it's a perpetual challenge.
Okay, what else?
Third, and this is perhaps one of the most critical and inherently challenging aspects for any P&C insurer, is loss reserve adequacy.
We touched on this with social inflation. Reserves are just estimates, right?
Exactly. Reserves are management's best estimate today of the ultimate cost to settle all the claims that have already occurred, even if they haven't been reported yet. For those long-tail casualty lines, the final cost might not be truly known for many years, even decades. So there's an inherent risk that these initial estimates prove to be inadequate, especially with the kind of pressures we're seeing from social inflation in the U.S. legal environment.
And if reserves are inadequate?
If they discover a material reserve deficiency, they'd be required to strengthen their reserves, basically add more money to the pot. That would directly reduce their reported earnings and capital in the period they recognize it. Arch's prudent reserving philosophy is designed as a key mitigator here, but it remains a significant inherent risk across the industry.
Makes sense. What's number four?
Fourth is simply competition. As we established earlier, the markets Arch operates in are highly competitive. They compete based on price, the amount of capacity they offer, policy terms and conditions, service levels, and, of course, financial strength ratings.
And this competition getting tougher?
Well, The current abundance of capital, especially in property lines and flowing in from alternative sources, has certainly led to increased competitive pressures recently. That could continue to moderate pricing, particularly in property reinsurance, and potentially compress returns somewhat from the recent peaks. They have to constantly fight for good business.
Okay, one more.
Finally, there's macroeconomic sensitivity. Arch's results aren't immune to broader economic forces. Inflation, as we discussed, can increase claims costs, particularly for repairing property or replacing vehicles. Changes in interest rates directly impact the value of their large fixed income investment portfolio and the income it generates. And general economic conditions, things like unemployment rates, GDP growth, housing market activity, they directly affect the performance of their mortgage segment and can also influence the overall demand for insurance products generally. So they're tied to the health of the economy.
All right, let's try to put a value on this. How do we value a complex company like Arch Capital? Our analysis emphasizes assessing it relative to its own historical ranges, its direct peers, and importantly, factoring in its superior profitability track record. We should note ACGL's market capitalization is currently around $33 billion.
Right. Valuing insurers involves looking at a few key metrics. Primarily, we look at multiples of earnings and book value. So things like the price-to-earnings ratio, or PE, price-to-book value, or PB, and sometimes price-to-tangible book value, PTBV, which strips out intangible assets like goodwill. And we always consider these in the context of profitability, typically measured by return on equity or ROE.
Okay, so where does Arch stand on those metrics right now, based on the analysis?
Currently, Arch Capital is trading at a trailing 12-month, or TTM, PE ratio of about 9.1 times earnings. Its PD is approximately 1.6 times book value, and its PTBV is around 1.7 times tangible book value. And its TTM ROE, as we mentioned, is running at a strong 18.4%.
And how does that compare to its peers?
Well, that's where it gets interesting. We need to compare it to a selection of peers across its different segments, maybe specialty insurers like W.R. Berkley and Markel, reinsurers like RenaissanceRe and Everest Group, and even mortgage insurers like MGIC and Radian to really understand the relative landscape.
So what do these numbers tell us about Arch's current valuation? Is it cheap? Expensive? Fair.
Let's take the P.E. ratio first. Arch Capital's TTM P.E. of around 9.1x appears, well, pretty attractive, both on an absolute basis and relative to peers.
How so?
It's significantly below the PE multiples of many of its key specialty insurer peers, like W.R. Berkley and Markel, which often trade in the mid-teens or higher. It's also well below the broader U.S. insurance industry average PE, which is closer to 14.5x. And notably, it's also trading well below Arch's own 10-year average PE, which is around 13.2x.
So on earnings, it looks potentially inexpensive.
Potentially, yes. It suggests a possibly favorable entry point based on that metric alone.
Okay, what about the book value multiples? PP and PTBV are often seen as the primary valuation metrics for insurers.
Right. Arch's price to book of about 1.6x, it's actually a premium compared to its pure play reinsurance peers and its mortgage insurance peers, which often trade closer to 1.0x or 1.2x book. However, it's a significant discount compared to a high-quality specialty insurance peer like W.R. Berkley, which, as the analysis notes, trades way up around 2.9x book value.
That's a big difference between Arch at 1.6x and Berkley at 2.9x.
It is. Arch's price-to-tangible book value is slightly higher at 1.7x, which just reflects that Arch has minimal intangible assets on its balance sheet. Importantly, this current multiple of around 1.6x to 1.7x book is pretty much within its own recent historical range. For example, it was 1.80x at the end of 2022 and 1.51x at the end of 2023. So it's not wildly out of line with its recent past.
Okay, now here's what the analysis suggests is perhaps the most insightful way to assess an insurer's valuation, looking at its price-to-tangible book value in the context of its return on equity. Explain that connection for us. How does generating a high ROE justify a higher multiple?
This is really key for understanding insurer valuations. The basic idea is that a company that can sustainably generate a higher return on equity is compounding its intrinsic value much faster for shareholders. It's creating more value each year from its existing equity base. Therefore, theoretically, it deserves to trade at a higher multiple of its book value compared to a company with lower or more volatile returns.
So higher quality earnings and growth deserve a higher price tag relative to the assets.
Exactly. Now let's apply that to Arch. As we've seen, Arch has consistently demonstrated its ability to generate a high and relatively stable ROE. That TTM operating ROE of 18.4% is truly at the top end of its broad peer group.
Okay.
Now, contrast that with its PTBV multiple of around 1.7x. Remember W.R. Berkley. It also generates a similarly high ROE, but it trades at a PB multiple of 2.9x, a substantial premium to Arch. This creates what the analysis sort of hints at as the W.R. Berkley paradox when comparing the two directly.
Why the difference then if ROEs are similar?
That's the multi-billion dollar question. It could be due to perceived differences in business mix, growth prospects, risk profiles, or maybe just historical market preferences. Conversely, if you look at Arch's reinsurance peers, they often trade closer to 1.0x book value, but they've historically generated lower and much more volatile ROEs than Arch.
So putting it all together, what does this ROE versus PTBV analysis suggest about Arch's valuation?
It strongly suggests that Arch Capital's current valuation may not fully reflect its superior and consistent value creation capabilities, as demonstrated by that high ROE. A PTBV multiple of 1.7x for a company that has proven its ability to compound tangible book value at high teen rates, driven by disciplined, cycle-aware underwriting, well, it appears justified, perhaps even conservative.
So the market might be being too cautious.
Possibly. The current valuation might imply that the market is pricing in a significant reversion to the mean for Arch's profitability as the P&C cycle inevitably softens further. However, Arch's uniquely diversified business model and its long, disciplined track record suggest it might be better positioned than most of its peers to navigate those changing market dynamics effectively. That resilience could potentially justify a more premium valuation than it currently receives relative to its demonstrated earning power.
Okay, let's try to bring all these threads together now. Our comprehensive analysis of Arch Capital Group seems to reveal a truly best-in-class specialty underwriter. If you had to summarize its core investment strengths, what really stands out?
Yeah, I think the key strengths are pretty compelling and clear. First, you have to start with their elite underwriting and cycle management culture. It's their core identity, the engine that drives superior underwriting margins and helps them avoid those market share traps.
Okay, number one.
Second is their demonstrated superior and consistent value creation. That exceptional track record of compounding book value per share at high rates, backed by high and relatively stable ROE. That's the ultimate proof.
Right.
Third is that powerful diversified business model. That unique three-segment structure, insurance, reinsurance, mortgage, providing more stable earnings, and crucial capital allocation flexibility. It's a real structural advantage.
Right.
Fourth, their disciplined and shareholder-aligned capital allocation approach. They prioritize profitable growth first, then strategic M&A, and then diligently return excess capital, as highlighted by that significant special dividend decision. It shows real discipline.
Okay, and finally?
And finally, they seem to be benefiting from some still generally favorable macro and market tailwinds. Pricing remains firm in key casualty and specialty lines where they focus, and they're getting that significant boost to earnings from higher net investment income thanks to rising interest rates. So several strong positives.
Okay, that's the bull case. But, as we always say, while the investment case looks strong, potential investors absolutely must consider the key risks and potential headwinds. What are the main concerns to keep in mind?
Absolutely. No investment is risk-free. The primary concerns highlighted include, first, the risk of peak earnings and cycle maturation. The P&C industry cycle is likely past its absolute peak, especially in property lines. This could lead to some inevitable margin compression as competition increases. Are the best earnings already behind them for this cycle? That's a key question.
Okay, cycle risk. What else?
Second, there's that inherent catastrophe volatility. Their earnings and capital are always exposed to the unpredictable nature of large-scale natural or man-made events. A bad cat year can significantly impact results.
Third
is the long-tail casualty reserve risk. Despite their conservative approach, they remain subject to the uncertainties of social inflation and evolving legal trends, particularly in the U.S. There's always a risk reserves could prove inadequate down the road.
And finally,
while the recent leadership transition appears to have been very well executed and seamless, any change at the very top always introduces at least some small degree of uncertainty regarding the long-term preservation of their unique and highly successful corporate culture. Something to watch.
Okay, so weighing those strengths against those risks, what's the overall risk-reward profile here? How might it look for you, our listener, especially if you're considering this as part of a longer-term investment strategy?
Well, based on the analysis, Arch seems to present a potentially favorable asymmetric risk-reward profile for investors with a long-term horizon.
Asymmetric, meaning more upside than downside.
Potentially, yes. The downside seems reasonably well cushioned. You've got a valuation that doesn't look stretched, especially considering the ROE. They have a strong, conservatively managed balance sheet, excellent financial strength ratings, and that prudently positioned short-duration investment portfolio generating strong income, those factors should provide some support.
And the upside?
The upside potential is really driven by the company's proven, demonstrated ability to consistently compound its intrinsic value, its book value, at an industry-leading rate over the long term. That stems directly from those durable competitive advantages we've spent time unpacking. The underwriting discipline, the diversification, the specialty focus.
What's the biggest risk that could derail that?
The primary risk to that positive thesis would probably be the simultaneous occurrence of, say, a truly major capital eroding catastrophe event combined with a rapid and severe downturn in the P&C underwriting cycle. That kind of perfect storm would pressure both their underwriting and investment results concurrently and could certainly challenge the thesis.
So what does this all mean for you listening today? Where might a company like Arch Capital fit within your own portfolio considerations?
Well, Arch Capital Group could potentially serve as a core, high-quality holding within a diversified financial sector allocation for some investors. Its business model gives you exposure not only to the cyclical P&C insurance and reinsurance markets, but also to the more stable, credit-driven U.S. housing market via that unique mortgage insurance segment.
Does it add diversification benefits itself?
Potentially, yes. The analysis notes the stock's historically low beta, which is a measure of volatility relative to the overall market, is approximately 0.5. That suggests Arch's stock has historically exhibited a degree of stability and lower volatility compared to the broader market, which could be attractive for diversification.
So who is it potentially a good fit for?
I'd say for an investor seeking exposure to the financial services sector through a company that boasts a clearly superior management team, a very clear and disciplined long-term strategy, and crucially, a demonstrated track record of exceptional value creation over many years, Arch Capital certainly presents a compelling investment case to consider.
Wow. That was a truly comprehensive deep dive into Arch Capital Group Ltd. We've really gone from those broad, complex industry dynamics all the way down to the specific competitive advantages and the financial engine that drives this particular company.
Yeah, there's a lot there, but hopefully we've made it a bit clearer.
I think so. And the real value here for you listening is in understanding the nuances of how a company like this can not only navigate, but actually thrive in such a complex, risk-laden industry like insurance.
Discipline and strategy really matter in this space.
Absolutely. So as you consider everything we've unpacked today, here's a final thought. What aspect of Arch's disciplined approach, whether it's their rigorous cycle management, their unique diversification model, or maybe their capital allocation hierarchy, what do you think holds the most crucial lesson for navigating today's complex financial landscape, no matter what kinds of risks you might encounter in your own life or investments? Something to ponder. Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive.
Thanks for listening.
We look forward to joining you next time for another journey into being well-informed.